You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Madison School District is facing a lawsuit over its transgender policy. We hear arguments from both sides of the issue. First, there are growing calls to get rid of caucuses after the chaos with the Democratic caucus in Iowa last month. Our guest says this is just one example of one of a handful of big risks to elections in America: incompetence. In a new book, he shares a series of challenges facing American elections and some ways to solve them. Richard Hassan is a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. His new book is Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Before we dig into the challenges you lay out in the book, big picture, it seems like this all has you worried about the future of our election system in the United States. How worried are you?
Well, I should say that the main focus of election meltdown is not how strong our election system is by itself, but how much confidence do people have in the strength of our election system. That is, you know, we really need to worry about what the public thinks, because a democracy depends on holding a fair election and the losers agreeing that the result that is announced was a fair one and that they'll fight to the next time. And so there's all kinds of stresses now on our system. And according to recent polling by both NPR and the Associated Press, large numbers of people are concerned that their votes are not going to be safely and securely counted. So I'm very worried about this as we go into 2020.
Well, let's look into some of the things that might erode that confidence as you lay out in your book. And let's start with that point of incompetence in election management. Where do you see this happening?
So, you know, I would say by and large, our election officials do a pretty good job, often faced with severe budget constraints. It's not so sexy to fund election administration like getting a, you know, a new fire truck or something like that. But there are problems of incompetence in pockets around the country. Back in 2012, I wrote a book called The Voting Wars, and it opened with, I don't know if you remember this incident with Kathy Nicholas, who was the election administrator in Waukesha, who left about 15,000 votes out of her totals, and it flipped a state Supreme Court race from one candidate to another. We have these pockets of incompetence that occur throughout the country. Sometimes it happens with Democrats, sometimes with Republicans. But when there's a very close election, we don't focus on the 95% of the places where things went perfectly or close enough to perfectly. We focus on those places where there are problems. And there are enough places like that. And I just use examples from 2016 and 2018 in the book Election Meltdown to show that in a very close election, that those pockets of incompetence really can undermine the public's trust in the process.
Let's talk about solutions. It seems like one possible problem is that in many cases, you have a county clerk who runs as a Democrat or a Republican, or a secretary of state in states that aren't Wisconsin who's in charge of the process that are Democrats and Republicans. Does that create a perception or risk that people are going to see this as a partisan decision, whatever they do?
Well, I think that's part of it. But it's also, you know, when they're running an election, you know, let's take Broward County, Florida, where there were, you know, serious problems with Brenda Snipes, who election after election, major problems. In one election, she left out of sending absentee ballots to about 58,000 people. In another election, she left a medical marijuana initiative off the ballot. In 2018, which is the race I focus on, she couldn't get a recount completed in time. They actually got the numbers done. This was a U.S. Senate race between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott. And they didn't submit their vote totals. They missed by 2 minutes because her employee didn't know how to work the website to submit the vote totals. She was more than once reelected to office because it's a heavily Democratic town. There's not really partisan competition. A Republican's not going to win there, and nobody primaried her. And so I think that's not the exact problem you're talking about,
sure,
but that is a problem we need to think about, which is that you know, the reason to have a partisan election is supposedly to ensure assure accountability, but that doesn't always happen in a place that's dominated by one party.
How do we make sure we have competent election management everywhere we need it, county level, state level?
Well, so, you know, one of the challenges is that election administration in the United States is highly decentralized, right? Rather than holding one election in November, we're going to hold something like 8,000 or 9,000 elections. Lots of power to the states, lots and lots of power to the county or sub-county level where they hold elections. Ideally, I'd like to see a national system for our national elections. But in the short term, what we need are state secretaries of state or state election boards, whoever's in charge of the state, to impose competency standards and to point out and grade those election officials who continue to have problems. And voters need to pay attention, too. It's our responsibility to make sure that our election officials are not the ones who are messing up. And if they are, we need to demand change.
Talking to Rick Hassan, his new book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Another category you look at is voter suppression efforts, claims of widespread fraud in voting. You say most of these fraudulent claims, almost all of them, there's really not much to them.
Right. So, you know, back in 2012 when I was writing about this issue, I thought it was kind of open. You know, how much evidence were we going to have? And now by 2020, I think it's pretty clear that almost all of the claims of massive voter fraud that are made with no or virtually no evidence. And the book actually opens with a trial in Kansas over a very strict Kansas law that said if you want to register to vote, you have to provide documentary proof of citizenship, like your birth certificate or your naturalization certificate. And Kris Kobach, who was the Secretary of State of Kansas, one of these people notorious for claiming without evidence that voter fraud's a massive problem, he had to prove at this trial called Fish versus Kobach that non-citizen voting was a major problem which would justify this law. And he was able to put on whatever experts he wanted. And in the end of the day, while Kobach had claimed that what he had offered as evidence was the tip of the iceberg, the judge, a Republican-appointed fourth-generation Kansan, said there was no iceberg. There was just an icicle made up mostly of administrative error. And so how is it that this undermines voter confidence? Well, I think, and this came out in the AP NORC poll that was released today, large numbers of Republicans believe, because they hear these laws being passed in the name of preventing voter fraud, that voter fraud is a major problem in this country. And Democrats turn around looking at the evidence that voter fraud is not really the basis for this and think this must be a way of trying to shrink the electorate. And they believe that Republicans are trying to manipulate the election results. And so this fight over voter fraud and voter suppression leads both sides to believe the other side is cheating and undermines everyone's confidence in the process.
That statement about the lack of voter fraud has made you unwelcome among some Republicans. You also, though, claim that worries about the impact of voter suppression have been overstated by Democrats. Why is that?
Well, so, you know, let's take Wisconsin, for example. Hillary Clinton said that essentially that she lost Wisconsin in 2016 because of the state's voter ID law. And she cited to a very questionable study done by a Democratic outfit that said that 200,000 votes were depressed by the state's voter ID law. And lots of times these claims are being made without any good evidence. There was a subsequent study done by Ken Mayer of the University of Wisconsin that found a much smaller effect. It could have had an outcome, a determinative effect. But lots of times Democrats are exaggerating the effect of these laws. And I think what it ends up doing is getting into a battle over the social science evidence. Is there enough evidence to prove that an election would have flipped because of a voter ID law or not? And I think that's really the wrong question. The question is, why should the state get to deny an otherwise eligible voter the right to vote? Why put stumbling blocks if it's not justified by an important government interest like preventing voter fraud or promoting voter confidence? And since we know from the studies that these laws do not have that effect, I think that would be a better basis on which to discuss these things than for Democrats, as they sometimes do, to exaggerate the effects of these laws. I should say sometimes these laws do have big effects. That law in Kansas that I mentioned, that Show Me Your Papers law, we know that 30,000 people had their voter registrations put on hold because of this law and would not have been able to register or vote had a federal court not intervened. So some of these laws really do have a suppressive effect. Other laws don't have such a suppressive effect, in part because in response to them, Democrats mobilize, they get more people registered to vote, and they get more people voter identifications take other steps to try to militate against these new restrictive laws.
We're talking to Richard Hassan from the University of California, Irvine. His new book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes you'd like to see in our election system? Do you feel a distrust that the outcome doesn't really reflect the votes that happened? What would make you feel more confident about the outcome of our elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Richard Hasson about his new book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about voting and elections in the United States? Do you lack confidence in the outcome? What changes, if any, would you like to see? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. Marty is with us in Lake Geneva. Marty, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. It's my understanding that the percentage of voter fraud in Wisconsin back in 2016 was 0.0034. This roughly amounted to 219 instances of potential voting fraud, and as it turns out, that it was maybe 100 or so of those voters that went to the wrong polling place. And yet, Wisconsin passes a law for voter ID because it's such a rampant, disgrace in Wisconsin. And that is why I just... We know that the Republicans...
Marty, I got you. Rick, Marty, worried that the response disproportionate to the cause.
Well, I'd say it's not only disproportionate. If you look at the kind of election fraud that occurs, almost none of it is prevented by having a voter ID law. If you wanted to steal an election by stealing someone's identity, you'd have to go to the polling place, hope that the person you're impersonating, who's dead or moved or something, that someone at the polling place worker doesn't recognize that name and know that you're an imposter. You'd have to do this on a large enough scale, pay people to go into the polling place to try to vote for someone else. You can't verify how they're voting because they're in a voting booth or even if they've voted at all. That's why we see virtually no instances of an organized effort to try to steal elections in this way. So while voter ID laws tend to be very popular and they're often promoted in the name of preventing voter fraud, the kind of voter fraud we see, which typically occurs with the tampering with absentee ballots, for example, that has nothing to do with whether or not there's a voter ID law. So it's not just disproportionate, it's aimed at the wrong target.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Rick, I want to get into some more of the concerns you raise in your book. Another one is inflammatory rhetoric about stolen elections. Talk about what you see and how that could erode confidence.
Sure. Well, we had this unprecedented situation of Donald Trump claiming as the victor that 3 to 5 million fraudulent votes were cast in his election, all for his opponent, he told ABC's David Muir. About the same number, the 3 million number, as he lost the popular vote by. So this seemed to be a way for him to try to explain away why he had lost. There was absolutely no evidence of millions of non-citizen voters. The number of cases of non-citizen voting in the United States is very, very small, and I go through the evidence of that in Election Meltdown. But it's not just Trump making claims of stolen or rigged elections, claims which cause people to on that side to believe that the elections are capable of being stolen, that these elections are capable of being manipulated. I talk about the example of Stacey Abrams, who was running for governor of Georgia against Brian Kemp, who was the then Secretary of State. Kemp did some pretty terrible things in terms of trying to suppress the vote in Georgia, and I talk about it. But as with the Hillary Clinton case I described earlier, there was no good evidence that what he did actually swung the election. And so when you had someone like Sherrod Brown claiming that Stacey Abrams' election was stolen, or when you have Abrams herself refusing to accept Brian Kemp as the legitimate governor of Georgia, I think it undermines people's confidence. People might think, why should I even bother voting if the system is rigged? Why should I accept election results if I believe that there's cheating going on all the time? And so I think it's really dangerous when you hear politicians making claims of unsubstantiated claims of stolen elections, even if there are grounds to claim that there were certain unfairnesses in that election.
What's the solution to that, except for, I guess, hoping our political leaders behave in a mature fashion?
Well, what I basically say in my concluding chapter is that in dealing with the rhetoric problem, the best way to do it is to have really transparent, strong election procedures. The more competent election officials are, the more we're dealing with the actual evidence of what went on in a race, the clearer it is that votes have been fairly and accurately counted, the less oxygen these claims can get. And so, sure, there'll be some followers of a political leader who'll believe anything that the politician says. But for those in the middle, for those who might say, well, is there anything to this story? If the more you can point to a clean and fairly run election system, the better off you're going to be inoculated against this kind of incendiary rhetoric.
Let's bring on another caller now. Karina is with us in South Milwaukee. Karina, hi.
Hi. I completely agree with the previous caller as far as, you know, accurate voting. I heard earlier today that, you know, in Australia that they actually, you know, charge people if they do not vote. And on the one hand, I thought, oh, that's wonderful because it's going to make people vote. But then on the other hand, if they're voting without, you know, knowledge of the candidates, knowledge of the policies, then it's kind of like a blind vote.
Karina, thanks a lot for the call. Mandatory voting not on the table right now in the United States, Rick. But in terms of getting more voter participation, do you think some of these problems, if fixing them, the solutions you provide might motivate people to be more likely to vote?
Well, you know, for a long time, I've supported universal voter registration conducted by the federal government and a national voter ID card. It's something that has united Democrats and Republicans. They all dislike the idea. Democrats don't like the ID portion and Republicans don't like the universal aspect. But I think we spent so much time dealing with voter registration. If the federal government gave you a unique voter identification number when you turned 18 or when you became a U.S. citizen and that followed you around your entire life and you didn't have to worry about coming up with the documents to provide the, you know, to get the ID, the government would do that for you. I think we'd have a much more rational system. We wouldn't need to require people to vote, but it would just be very easy wherever you lived to be able to cast your ballot in federal elections. And I think that, that's not something that's going to be fixable by November. That's not one of my short-term solutions. But looking down the line, I would love to see a system like that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rick Hassan, author of the new book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Let's get into that dirty trick a bit and misinformation campaigns, another portion of your book. How are those eroding confidence in our voting?
Well, you know, you don't have to go, we can go back just a couple of weeks to the Iowa caucus meltdown. Very fortunate for my book publisher that my book came out the day that the Iowa caucus melted down. One of the things we saw was that immediately you had the president's campaign manager and children claiming that the election was rigged in order to help defeat Bernie Sanders. No evidence of this whatsoever. But you also had, you may remember there was this smartphone app that didn't work. So there was a backup phone number that precinct captains were supposed to call to report their election results to the Iowa Democratic Party. Well, over on the website 4chan, the phone number was produced, and the phone lines were jammed with supporters of President Trump trying to stop the Democrats from being able to participate in giving the vote totals. So you know, these kinds of dirty tricks have been around for a while, but now, with the rise of social media, things can spread very quickly through technology. It's not just the Russians engaging in a misinformation effort in 2016, but I think all of it really undermines people's confidence. It's not as though we're necessarily going to be taken in by all the misinformation that's floating out there. It's that we're going to start believing that everything that we see or read or hear is false, and that makes it hard to be a good citizen and a good voter when you don't know what information you can trust as you make your decisions.
You also lay out in your book a nightmare scenario, say Russian hackers who we know could shut down power plants in Ukraine, say they did it, you write, in a city like Detroit or Milwaukee on Election Day. What could be the impact? How could we prepare for kind of a, I guess, a black swan election event like that?
Sure. Well, there's nothing we can do as average citizens to make sure that our electrical grid is secure from cyber attack. But we can insist that our election officials have a plan B in place. we don't have good rules in place in most states, and certainly don't have anything from Congress to say what would happen if a presidential election were disrupted just on just in one place. You know, maybe that's Milwaukee. And certainly, you know, in a state as close as Wisconsin, if voters in Milwaukee couldn't get to the polls because the lights were out, that would, you know, certainly tip the election in one direction. We need to have a plan B. Every state needs to have a plan B. And, you know, I said that in my book, and that was before coronavirus. What if coronavirus shuts down polling places? We need to think proactively about what we need to do in the event of either a terrorist attack or a natural disaster that affects our elections in November.
In our last minute or so, the concerns you raise in your book, Rick, do you see people taking these concerns seriously enough to ensure an orderly transition, whatever the outcome of the next election might be?
Well, the best hope is that the election's not close, because then that makes it easier for there to be a transition. But I am very concerned. And what I hope will happen is over the next few months, we will think about all the areas, whether it's in tech, in law, in politics, in media, where there can be improvements in how we do things to try to minimize the chances that the losers don't accept the election results in 2020, knowing that no matter what happens, 47-48% of the population is not going to be happy with what the result is.
Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Richard Hasson, professor of law and public policy at the University of California, Irvine. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Still time to share your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, a new lawsuit challenges a policy on transgender students in the Madison School District. We'll get two perspectives on the issue. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin is a big player in the organic farming scene. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at organic operations around the state and the role they play in Wisconsin's economy. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Madison Metropolitan School District is facing a lawsuit over its transgender policy. The part of the policy in question deals with students who identify themselves with a name and or gender that's different than their sex at birth and legal name. Under the policy, educators are not required to alert parents of students making these changes at school and can opt to continue referring to the students by their legal name and birth sex when communicating directly with the parents. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, has pushed back against the policy, arguing it violates parents' constitutional rights. The group recently filed a lawsuit against the district on behalf of a group of more than a dozen individual parents from MMSD families. We're going to hear from guests on both sides of this story today, starting with Luke Berg, deputy counsel for WILL. Luke, thanks a lot for coming to the studio today.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, make out the basics for us here, the ways you believe the policy violates parents' constitutional rights.
Well, parents have a right to be involved in major decisions that affect their children, and gender dysphoria can be a very serious psychological issue, and transitioning in particular is a major life-changing decision. This is exactly the type of thing that parents should be involved in.
I want to read from a statement from the school district here regarding the suit. It's a bit lengthy, but MMSD, I'm quoting, prioritizes working in collaboration with families to support our students, and it's always our preferred method of support. MMSD must also prioritize the safety and well-being of every individual student who walks through its doors each day. It is with this focus the district stands by its guidance document on transgender and non-binary students and recognizes its tremendous responsibility to uphold the right of every child to be educated in a safe, all-inclusive and non-discriminatory learning environment. So that statement from the school district, what's your response to that?
I think the best way to protect kids and to care for kids is to involve their parents when significant issues come up. I mean, the school does this regularly with everything. The district requires parental consent for athletics, prom, taking medication at school, field trips, most classes, everything. And yet the district has carved out this one issue, which is significant and controversial, and decided that parents don't need to be involved. And in fact, the district will help hide this from the parents. I think it's pretty clear that this violates parents' rights.
A concern that people raise is safety of kids. They point out that transgender youth are disproportionately represented among homeless youth. There are concerns that those students might not feel safe in their home revealing this information. What would you say to those concerns?
I think children might be afraid of how their parents will respond or react, but the vast majority of parents are going to respond in love and do everything they can to do what's best for their child. Now, some parents may ultimately say, no, we don't think it's best for you to transition, but that's not going to do harm necessarily. And the school district can't presume from the get-go that parents are going to do harm to their children. Courts have been very clear that government can't make that assumption, and in fact, it has to make the opposite assumption. It has to assume that parents will do what's best for their kids. And yet this policy presumes the opposite.
Talking to Luke Berg, Deputy Counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The organization is representing parents of students in the Madison School District, challenging the district's policy on transgender students. Luke, what remedy are you looking for in this lawsuit from the district?
So we're asking the court to order that the district require parental notice and consent before students can transition at school. Parents need to be involved. One of the reasons they need to be involved is because gender dysphoria is frequently associated with other psychological comorbidities, depression, suicide, and the like. So at the very least, parents need to be involved to have their child professionally evaluated and to provide any mental health support that their child might need.
Now, you're representing a group of anonymous parents. Can you share some of the current concerns you've heard from them, apart maybe just from the direct constitutional issues you're raising?
Well, the parents want to be involved in their children's lives, as I imagine all parents do. And, you know, they don't know whether their children will deal with this issue or not. But if their children ever do deal with this issue, they don't want the district to hide it from them. They want to be involved, and they want to work through this with their kids, with the district, and do what is best for their child. And that may or may not involve transitioning.
This is a case in Madison now. Is this something you're seeing? Are you seeing similar policies elsewhere in the state, or are you hearing from parents in other districts raising these concerns?
Yeah, this is actually happening across the country. It's a relatively new phenomenon, but there's been some groups who have been pushing policies like this on school districts, and I think parents are just starting to become aware that this is happening. Ours is the first case that I'm aware of to challenge it, but I doubt it will be the only one.
Now, the case could be looked at as a question of whose protected rights outweigh the other, the students or the parents. There was a 2017 decision by a panel of judges for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in favor of Wisconsin transgender students' bathroom preference. Some people have read this case, and not everybody has, as implying a federal protection for transgender students from discrimination. Does this weigh into this case that you're bringing here?
So my understanding is that case involved a situation where the parents and the student were on the same page about something. You know, the default rule as a legal matter is that most rights begin when you turn 18, and prior to that, parents have substantial authority. Now, as a practical matter, good parenting is the process of slowly releasing control and allowing children to make decisions on their own, obviously with parental input and guidance. And I imagine parents will differ in when they would allow their children to make this decision on their own. And the answer may depend on the child and the circumstances as well. It should. But the important point is that's a decision for parents to make. That's not a decision for the school district to preempt and make on its own. It's also worth pointing out that the district's policy has no age limit whatsoever. So for any listeners who think that, you know, students should have a right to make this decision on their own at some age, surely an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old doesn't have a right to make this decision totally independently. We don't give children rights to make significant decisions like this without parental involvement for any other decision of this magnitude.
What is the timeline in this suit now?
So we've filed a motion for a temporary injunction, which is a request to a court to order the district to halt the policy. We're in the process of talking with the district's counsel to come up with a schedule. That hasn't been set yet, but I imagine this will be briefed and heard in the next couple months, and then the court will rule.
Is this, you're saying you're seeing this elsewhere in the state and the country, is this going to be the first, do you think, of many cases bringing a suit against schools over these kind of policies?
To the extent there are schools around the country doing this, I hope so. This is not the type of thing that schools should do. As far as in the state, I'm aware that Kenosha recently has been developing a transgender policy and had a debate about this issue, and Kenosha ultimately decided to require parental consent before students can make the life-changing decision to transition at school. I think that's the right approach, and we asked Madison to change its policy to that. It chose not to, and so now we're in a lawsuit.
And to clarify, before we wrap up, it's the parental consent that is the key, if I'm hearing you right. With parental consent, you have no objection to the rest of the policy when it comes to teachers using, say, preferred pronouns, for example.
That's exactly right. And a lot of parents would be fully on board with their children transitioning and might support that. But even those parents, I think, would want to be involved. They would want the district to notify them so that they can be a part of the plan, be a part of the conversation.
Luke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Luke Berg, Deputy Counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We talked to him today about the lawsuit that the group filed against Madison School District on behalf of parents over the school district's transgender policy. Coming up, we talked to an opponent of that lawsuit. That's up next on Central Time.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas, and thanks.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a lawsuit facing the Madison School District over its transgender policy for students. Earlier, we heard from a representative from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. They brought the lawsuit on behalf of a group of MMSD parents. Now, for another take on the issue, we're joined by Brian Jay, co-director of the group GSAFE, which advocates for LGBTQ plus youth in schools. Brian, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you, Rob. It's nice to be here.
Where do you see problems with this lawsuit?
Well, actually, I just want to acknowledge that I know that there's a lot of transgender friends, family, colleagues, students listening right now. And even though previous guests, you know, stated things, you know, in a nice and polite way, I also want to recognize and acknowledge that that probably felt really rough for them and felt harmful to them and contributed to the sense of fear that I know that they've been feeling since this lawsuit has been introduced. And it also fits into a larger effort to attack transgender individuals. So I just want to recognize that I know that people are listening and that was probably a hard thing for them to hear just now.
So with the lawsuit in particular.
So, and your question is?
Where do you see problems? Where do you challenge the premise here?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, you know, the conversation is about a transgender policy, and really it's not a policy, it's just guidance that the district's put together based on policy. But I think when people use the term transgender policy, I think, one, that's not an accurate way to talk about it. Second of all, I think, you know, the premise that schools need to out students before students are ready to be out to their families, I think that creates a whole lot of challenges and problems for young people in schools. You know, it's very natural. Like when we think about the way that people come out, usually they're coming out to friends first, and that they're coming out to a trusted adult, usually a teacher at school second, and then they build the confidence to share that with their families. So, when I hear Will and other folks talking about this lawsuit, I think they're imagining that schools are actively hiding or keeping information from families. And I think what I've known in the work that I've done with the Madison School District, as well as with other school districts around the state, is that, of course, schools want to be in conversation with families. And 95% of the time, families are involved in these conversations. So I think the perception out there is very different from what the reality is.
But the concern is that in that 5% of cases, there might be parents not aware of this big thing going on in their kids' lives and not wanting them to make these really critical decisions without them on board.
Right. And of course, schools want parents to be involved in this, those conversations. You know, when a student comes out to a staff member, that conversation starts the process of figuring out, how can we support you? How can we help you in sharing this information with your family? So it's not hiding it from the family, but really helping the student figure out, how are they going to have those conversations with their parents with the support of schools, not necessarily schools saying pro or con, but just really schools doing what they do really well, which is supporting the safety and supporting young people as they navigate some of these really challenging things in their lives.
Another point of clarification, we have a caller wondering, when we're using the word transition in school, we're not talking about any kind of medical transition here.
Right. So absolutely. And thank you, caller, for pointing that out. Right. We're talking about social transitions. We're talking about using the name and pronoun that people use and or want to be called, which is something that schools do all the time. Right. So, you know, if we're thinking about cisgender students, in other words, students who aren't transgender, schools have long been in the habit of using the preferred names and pronouns that they use. So my dad had a different name at school than was what was on his birth certificate. So I think schools are already doing that. So schools aren't doing any medical intervention. They're not, you know, acting as doctor. Really, all they're doing is saying, hey, this is what you want to be called at school. Great. That's what we do. And we're going to do it. And we're going to support you in that.
Now, we talked to my previous guest and I talked about safety concerns. Is that part of the story here that that has you worried if this lawsuit is successful?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we know is that most of the time when students come out to their families, even though sometimes it can be rocky at the start, generally families come around and are supportive. But what we know is that sometimes, you know, not every family is supportive. And we know that students do get thrown out and they do get kicked out. They do get abused by their families. And then also, I think the thing that we might forget about is that threat of being outed to your family can be really traumatic for a young person. And we know that there's been cases in this country where government officials, schools have threatened to out or have outed students to their families without the permission of the students. And that has resulted in students committing suicide or inflicting some significant self-harm upon themselves.
Another concern raised in the lawsuit is that if we have the student in what's sometimes called gender dysphoria is the phrase they use in the lawsuit, some families for religious reasons or other reasons might not agree that changing pronouns and other things like that is the right course of action. And the concern again raised in the lawsuit is they're left out of making that decision with their kid.
Well, parents don't have the right to trump the way that schools do things based on religious viewpoints, first of all. So, I mean, I think that's important to recognize or to apply their religious viewpoint upon all families. These are public schools that we're talking about. And I think, the other thing that I think about is, you know, oftentimes, sometimes there's things that families do that they think are protecting their young person, such as, you know, not letting them be the gender identity that they are or not using the names and pronouns that the student uses, that they think is, when they take those actions, they think that they're being protective of their student, oftentimes acting from genuine concern for the child. But what we know from research and from data out there that those behaviors and actions that they see as protective are actually quite harmful to young people, to the health and well-being of young people.
Talking to Brian Jay, co-director of the group G-Safe, about a lawsuit from the group Will challenging the Madison Metropolitan School District for its guidelines on transgender students. Will is representing a group of parents raising concerns about this. As you pointed out, Brian, this is guidelines. This is not policy. Do you see school districts doing enough to clarify where they are on this issue in general?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that I think schools have been developing this guidance is that, one, there's not a consistent practice across schools. So we know that, the practice that the Madison School District or the procedures that the Madison School District adopted are based on the best practices that school districts across the country have used. So this isn't something that they created out of thin air. This is something that really is following best practice and that's been recommended by different professional education organizations.
What do you think of the response so far from the Madison School District to the lawsuit and the statements they've made?
Yeah, well, I know that the Madison School District has been very firm in the fact that they are standing behind their transgender students and that they're standing firm with their guidance. And I think that's the right action. I think our students are scared. I know that our families are scared. And first and foremost, really, the school has that responsibility to create that sense of safety for students and look out for the safety of students. So I think they're on the right course.
Right. So parents and students have talked to you and your group about their concerns about this lawsuit?
Yeah, absolutely. So this definitely contributes to a climate of fear for young people and concern for young both the young people as well as for the adults. And I think it also is asking, ultimately, what Will is asking is for educators to intentionally do harm to young people. And again, most of the time, families and schools are in communication. But in those rare cases where families aren't at that place where they can be supportive, I think forcing a decision or denying students the right to guide their own process of coming out really can do substantial harm.
As you look at this in Madison, do you, as we talked to our previous guest, he said this will probably come up in other districts. Are you concerned that we'll see similar lawsuits elsewhere in the state?
It's always a possibility. I know that there's efforts to curtail or prevent schools from supporting transgender students, and it ties into larger efforts to undermine the rights of transgender people, both in our state as well as our country. So I know that, it's an election year, and this is often a very popular topic to bring up to create, the divisiveness. So I am concerned that it's going to come up, and I'm hoping that this particular lawsuit, is addressed and it's found to not have merit to, make sure that other lawsuits don't pop up.
What would you say to one of the anonymous parents behind this lawsuit, if they were listening, what would you say to them to try to address some of their fears here?
Yeah, well, and again, as I mentioned earlier, I do think that oftentimes, parents really want to protect their children. We know that, ultimately the role of adolescents is to, become their own person. And so I think if we're a parent that's concerned about, our child, I think one, we need to be having really good, clear conversations with our child and being really transparent with them about, I love you and I support you no matter who you are, which I think opens doors for those honest conversations with students. And again, I think I would also recommend to families to recognize that some of those gut instincts to protect your child, again, either not, using their name or pronoun or wanting to somehow make them not transgender, that might feel really loving and protective. But ultimately, we know that that has a significant harm on your young person and ultimately isn't going to change who they are.
We'll leave it there and watch and see how this develops. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Brian Jay, co-director of GSAFE. He joined us for a look at a lawsuit that challenges transgender guidance provided by Madison's school district. Earlier, we heard from Luke Berg, deputy counsel from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which brought the lawsuit on behalf of a group of MMSD parents. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, what does the American economy look like for people at the high school education level? An expert on jobs and the economy joins the show, and you can share your experiences in the workplace. A weed killer went from a popular product to a health hazard in the subject of lawsuits. We'll talk to the author of the book Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll look at great places to get our recipes in books, online, and beyond. And we want to hear from you. You can share your favorites and find some new ones as well. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.